What's up, everyone? Welcome to the Hash Rate Podcast. Thank you for tuning into the show. On today's episode, I am joined by Zach Prince, the founder and CEO of BlockFi, an absolute behemoth in the Bitcoin lending space. Zach and his team are working on much more than Bitcoin lending, and we certainly talk about the products and services that they are currently offering and that they plan to offer in the future, especially their credit card, which I'm amped for. We also talk about the financialization of mining. He gives me some time to share with him my thoughts on hash rate and the derivative products that can spring up around that. He shares his story. We get into quite a lot in this, 35 minutes or so that we're chatting, and I'm super grateful that Zach was able to make the time. I hope you all enjoyed this episode. If you do, please make sure that you leave us a rating and review on your preferred listening platform. And now we are on to the show with Zach. Enjoy. Hey everyone, welcome to the Hash Rate Podcast. I am the Bitcoin Broski, and I've got a very special guest today. I've been looking forward to getting this gentleman on the show for quite some time now. Everybody welcome Zach Prince, CEO and founder of BlockFi. Zach, welcome to the show.
Bitcoin Broski, thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here, and sorry for rescheduling once or twice. My calendar is getting increasingly unwieldy these days, but I'm really pumped to be here.
Listen, I know you are a busy man. You and the BlockFi team have been just crushing it. When did the company launch?
So we were incorporated in August of 2017, but we didn't really have any money until December of 2017 when we raised our seed round. So it was a lot of the super early stage stuff with no real product and market that happened for the first few months there. But we've been around, technically over 3 years now, 3 years and a month.
Well, my entire time in crypto, you guys have just been on the rocket ship up. I mean, it seems like the social profile has continued to grow. So it's been great to see you as a startup just continue to propel forward. And obviously people love the product. So why don't we give a quick overview for anyone who's been, living under a rock in Bitcoin and crypto and hasn't heard of BlockFi. What does the company do?
So we have a number of products in the market today. Some are kind of publicly accessible and they're available in our mobile app or our web app. You can earn interest on your cryptocurrency and cash holdings. It's our most popular product. It's called the BlockFi Interest Account. We currently offer an 8.6% annual yield on stablecoins, 6% yield on Bitcoin, 4.5% yield on Ether. We recently added PaxG, which is a gold-backed token, to the interest account. Earn yield on that too. And then also in our mobile app, you can buy and sell cryptocurrencies with no fee, and you can get a loan secured by the value of your portfolio that you have on BlockFi at rates as low as 4.5%. So that stuff is all completely public. It's like a, fintech company. Yep. In the mobile app, on the website, everything's automated. And then we have an institutional side of our platform where we manage all of the risk in terms of the different activities that we're doing. I'm happy to say that since making our first loan in January of 18, we've had perfect performance, with no losses throughout our entire history. Our institutional team is the largest lender of cryptocurrencies and dollars to institutional crypto market participants in the world. Wow. So we, on the cryptocurrency lending side, are providing financing solutions to primarily market makers and proprietary trading firms. So if anyone's read the Flash Boys book by Michael Lewis, a lot of the names that you would see in that book are active in the crypto sector and clients of ours. The reason they borrow from us is because, like every other market that they participate in, they want to finance those activities, but they can't finance them with their traditional prime brokers, whether that's Goldman or Morgan Stanley or others.
Right.
We also lend dollars on the institutional side of our business, but that's today more concentrated with crypto native companies, whether that's miners or ATM businesses or OTC desks or others. And that's kind of everything that we do today. About 6 months from now, we'll be launching a Bitcoin Rewards credit card product that we're really excited about. That'll be available to everyone. So we'll have our first payments product. And fortunately, we've been on a pretty impressive, when compared to other venture-backed fintech companies, growth streak recently, which I think has been built by the value that our clients see in our product suite, but also an increasing push that we've very consciously made as a company to, as we've grown, continually target a more and more mainstream audience. So, a year ago, if you were earning interest on your Bitcoin at BlockFi, odds are you've been in the cryptocurrency market for quite a while. Mm-hmm. You've heard about us pretty early in our evolution. But today we're branching out into more mainstream media channels and trying to, you know, not only grow our platform, but grow the sector overall, which is really fun.
So Zach, to that point, when you're branching out and getting to more of the mainstream, what different strategies have you adopted to get that broader audience?
So I think you have to kind of start from a place of education. If you're communicating with someone who hasn't done anything in the crypto market before, generally it's scary and intimidating to
right.
them.
Yeah.
To think about it for one reason or another, you know, either they think it's too technologically complicated, or they think that it's risky because it's illegal, or, you know, all of these things are like misconceptions at the end of the day. But you have to get over this kind of initial education hurdle and get around whatever someone's, you know, concerns or lack of knowledge has been around the space. So we've started to, in terms of our own writing on our blog, create pieces of content that are more mainstream. In terms of produced media things that we've done, we're doing stuff that's more mainstream. So I'm trying to go talk on, you know, Yahoo Finance now instead of CoinDesk TV.
Sure.
We did an event about a week ago that we put together with Benzinga, and we had, you know, a lot of the big names in crypto speak, but we also had folks like Chamath Palihapitiya, who right. is very mainstream, and he's on CNBC all the time, come and speak. And it was less, you know, bang people over the head with crypto and more start from a place of what are the benefits of having diversification in your investment portfolio? How do institutional investors allocate to alternatives, which is actually, you know, they do that at a much higher percentage mm-hmm. than most retail investors. And, you know, they do that for a reason, because it's attractive.
Yep.
It's an attractive thing to do. Where does cryptocurrency fit in to that alternatives allocation within a portfolio? And then why are certain cryptocurrencies, particularly Bitcoin, well-suited to continue to have the portfolio diversification benefits and the performance benefits that they've had to date? I think a lot of times, one of the struggles that we have as an industry is that there are a ton of like idealistic, you know, narratives that you can hang on to in the cryptocurrency world.
Well, and put, that was a very safe way of putting it. Yeah, absolutely.
You know, whether you believe in those or not, they're not necessarily the best way to introduce someone who's new to the space to the asset class all the time. Like
right.
if you come from a position of wanting to have like a philosophical battle with somebody about Bitcoin versus the dollar, they might clam up.
Right.
If you come at it from a position of let's take philosophy out of it, let's take sentiment out of it. Over the last 10 years, a portfolio with anywhere from a 1 to 10% allocation to Bitcoin in it not only was less volatile, but it also delivered better returns.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's just so simple. And so,
right.
we're trying to also enable the industry to have that conversation in a really sophisticated way. And then, of course, a certain percentage of the people who, you know, get involved will also be drawn to the philosophical side of it.
Sure.
But I think a lot of those people are already here. And the question is, how do we grow this? So that's what we're, you know, trying to do.
So with that approach, would you say that the current push towards the mainstream is mostly for the institutional products? Are you seeing that there is a retail uptick on the mainstream side as opposed to just the crypto side?
I mean, we definitely are. It's still early days for us as a company. And I think if you look at things like Google search trends, I think we're still early innings of what, you know, I believe will turn into a kind of second large adoption wave sometime mm-hmm. over the next couple of years. But it's definitely starting to happen. And the next kind of big moment for us that we hope to have is with the Bitcoin Rewards credit card launch, where we're going to do just a ton of like really fun advertising and marketing in very mainstream channels, whether that's TV or with YouTube influencers. And the product, you know, I was really excited about the product pre-COVID. I'm even more excited about the product post-COVID, because part of what we're competing with in telling people that earning Bitcoin rewards on a credit card is a great idea is the alternative, which is what a lot of people are doing today, earning airline points or
right.
you know, L points.
Rewards they can't use. Yeah.
It's really easy to knock those things pre-COVID because they depreciate in value every year. They kind of, you know, suck when you actually try to use them a lot of the time. But now, in addition to that, we're not even traveling.
Right.
Like we're not even traveling. So it's a really interesting kind of time to be bringing something like that to market. And then obviously, you know, Bitcoin's performance helps a lot. Best performing asset class of this year, if you compare it to, you know, gold or the S&P 500 or commodities or bonds. And I think that will continue. So you got to kind of wrap all those things up in a super fun mainstream way. And fortunately, the product is not intimidating at all, because unless you've, to use an expression that you lived earlier, unless you're really living under a rock, you know how credit cards work and you know how reward points on credit cards work. So
absolutely,
like, it's not a complicated thing to wrap your head around. Yeah. How would I get some Bitcoin? It's like, you just get the Bitcoin instead of your Delta miles, right?
So
like
it's funny that you mentioned that, because I think the one thing that most people at my age is kind of the cutoff. I would say, you know, anyone who's 25 or younger, one thing they don't know how it works is like an interest-bearing account at your bank, right? Because you just don't have them. Like nobody has a savings account at a traditional bank that's going to pay them interest at all. Has there been that educational hurdle to overcome? Like, because it is almost one of those, it seems too good to be true scenarios, right? Because if I've kept my money in a place for my entire life and they've never given me anything for it, in fact, they've charged me for it, now I'm able to put my Bitcoin with BlockFi, I'm going to get paid just to leave it there. Is that an educational hurdle that's had to be overcome?
Definitely. So it's insane to think that, you know, our parents in like the 80s were getting 7% in their like checking account with a bank. Like that seems like such a foreign concept to anyone who's, you know, around our age, where, you know, we high five about 1.75% when rates ticked up for a very brief period of time recently. It's like, oh my God, like there's actually like some level of
living the life. Yes.
Yeah. So we get the question all the time of, you know, how are you able to do this? And fundamentally, an account at BlockFi is not FDIC insured. So it's not apples to apples. Mm-hmm. And we're, you know, very clear about that in terms of our marketing. We tell people, you know, you can't think of this exactly the same as a savings account, because if something, you know, were to happen to BlockFi, we don't think it will. But if something were to happen to BlockFi, the federal government doesn't have some insurance program that's, you know, backstopping your balances on our platform.
Right.
Whereas in a bank account, obviously that exists up to certain, you know, limits per account.
Sure.
Or whatever. So if someone can get comfortable with that and they say, okay, I understand that risk, I'm comfortable potentially taking it, but what are the odds that something would actually happen to BlockFi? Like, you know, peel back that onion a little bit more for me. And why the hell are you able to pay me 8.6% on dollars that I send to you that you hold as stablecoins? The fundamental reason is that we're financing the cryptocurrency sector. The cryptocurrency sector is a rapidly growing global kind of new economy of sorts that doesn't have access to any traditional financing. So you could run a small, sleepy business that doesn't have great growth prospects of any kind and walk into a bank and borrow money at, you know, 2, 3, 4, maybe 5% these days.
Right.
You can't walk into a bank as a cryptocurrency company and borrow money at any rate.
You barely open an account at this point.
You can barely open an account.
Yeah.
So the ecosystem overall doesn't have access to the same type of financing, the same type of debt capital,
right,
that more established industries do. And as a result, when we're lending, we're able to charge higher rates, even though the type of lending that we're doing is a lot less risky than a $20,000 loan to a pizza shop that is, you know, not secured by anything. A lot of the lending that we're doing is secured by liquid collateral, which stays on our platform throughout the course of the loan. And as a result, if prices move in a certain direction, we can issue margin calls or, you know, sell it eventually. And that's the main part of the reason why we've never lost a penny across any of the lending that we do. So you've got this lending pool risk and you understand how that works. And we post videos about it. And we talk about the different types of counterparties and what they're using it for and how our margining system, you know, works. And then the other thing you basically have is, well, what if BlockFi is just a scam, right? And you know, the arguments against us being a scam, I think, are, you know, pretty apparent to anyone who's willing to spend a bit of time looking into it. But, you know, we're backed by some incredibly smart and noteworthy investors, whether it's...
And you just closed was it a Series C?
Yeah, it was our Series C. So, I mean, we've raised over $100 million in equity. Yeah,
so just a little bit of due diligence that's been done by, you know, like some of the biggest investors in the country, potentially.
Yeah. people don't write checks that size lightly, and you know, they put us through the ringer every time, sure, in terms of understanding exactly what we're doing, how it all works. Also, if you look at the company and the team, we're here in the US market. I'm talking, I know we're just doing voice, but mm-hmm, you know, doing this Zoom, I'm actually in our office in New York, even though we're not kind of like fully in the office right now. There's like five people here. It's a 150 person office. We're in the US. We're regulated in the US at both the federal and state level. And we're regulated like a fintech company. We're regulated like Square or SoFi or other names that people are very familiar with. And everyone on our team comes from the most reputable kind of traditional financial services or fintech backgrounds. And a lot of us have families, myself included. And we're not trying to, you know, do something that would put our future at risk. So then you kind of unpack that stuff and you're like, okay, well, doesn't seem like a fraud. And then that kind of translates into this really interesting client behavior that we see, where generally people open an account with BlockFi. And then in the first 30 days, they also make a withdrawal. And sometimes it's for their, you know, full balance. Sometimes it's for a partial balance. And generally that withdrawal happens after they get their first interest payment. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they're testing it out, understandably, right? Like, right. Okay, you're saying you're going to pay me 8.6. Like, I'm going to put $500 in. I get my first interest payment and I want to take all the money out. And like, can I actually do that? So then they do that. And then by day 60, their account is like 10 times the size of that first initial deposit. Cause they're like, they've tried it. They've educated themselves a little bit and they're like, this is awesome. And so, I mean, look, we're fortunate to, you know, have a product that is kind of a no-brainer, assuming you are comfortable with that account structure and the risks that exist. I mean, they're not zero. And so generally we see this, you know, kind of client behavior where accounts grow in value pretty substantially over time, especially in the first 90 days of someone's relationship with us. And one of the things that we invest in heavily to try and facilitate that is our client service team. Half the people that are here with me today are from our client service team. Like, I think we might have the best client service team in crypto. I think we're the only company that operates in the cryptocurrency sector that has a phone number on our website that you can call during the day and talk to a smartphone person who like probably works here because they love crypto and just like wanted to get into the industry at a cool company, and they're happy to like talk to people all day and explain how things work. So we invested a ton in that too. You know, we're not like the type of place where a client would send us, you know, an email or create a support ticket and we would take a week to respond to that. That's just like anathema to how I think a great company gets built and how we, you know, treat our clients. So,
well, I mean, in a situation like this, when you're dealing with people's money, you know, there needs to be an active response time when it comes to those kinds of things. Now, you'd mentioned the lending products. Who do you find are your biggest clients for those?
Yeah, so I would say today things that fall under kind of the umbrella of trading businesses is the largest. So that could be an exchange, it could be an OTC desk. The biggest segment for us right now is market making firms, mm-hmm, specifically market making firms who come from the traditional financial world and are active in the crypto space, but it's less than 5% of their overall activities. Right. The reason we do so much with them is that we really like them as counterparties from a risk perspective. You know, working with someone like Susquehanna, for example, who's also an equity investor in the company, is a lot less risky than working with an upstart market making firm that has $20 million. And Susquehanna has tens of billions of dollars. And so we can lend them, you know, 50 million or 100 million worth of Bitcoin. And we can sleep great at night knowing that they know what they're doing and it's not an excessive amount of risk. We're also expanding pretty aggressively now. I know you focus a lot on mining content for this podcast. We've started to do some really interesting things. We've done actually a couple transactions recently where we're doing either corporate financing for a mining firm or equipment financing for a mining firm or a combination of the two. We've gotten really, you know, sophisticated recently at our ability to underwrite cash flows and offer financing solutions that, you know, take into account kind of specific business considerations from miners, also from crypto ATM companies who we've also started to do more work with. And then, you know, we say retail, but like our retail client base, which also includes some very high net worth folks, is, you know, really big and growing fast as well. So it really is kind of like the full spectrum.
So on the mining product side, obviously that's of specific interest to me and probably to many of the listeners. On the products that you're offering, do you do hardware guaranteed financing or is it strictly based on cash flows?
We can do either. I mean, it kind of depends on the scenario, but we do have a team on board now who spends around half of their time specifically focused on evaluating opportunities with mining firms and trying to, you know, get something done. So, you know, to give you an example, we're not going to get comfortable anytime soon with financing hardware that sits in China, a facility that isn't owned by the mining operator. If there was a mining operator who was in the US with a facility that they, you know, leased from a reputable landlord or owned themselves, and all of this stuff was kind of very easy to diligence. There's also a big kind of spectrum in terms of quality of mining machines and the durability of value that you can anticipate from those mining machines. Obviously, it's an incredibly fast moving sector as well, and some stuff has a longer shelf life than others and it's hyper competitive.
Yep.
So I wouldn't say we necessarily prefer as a first option, you know, to rely only on hardware financing, but that doesn't mean it's not an option.
So that's a very intriguing thing for me. I know that for a lot of the facilities, especially in the US, borrowing based on cash flow is something they're familiar with. And I think a lot of them would rather use a debt instrument than, you know, go out and try to raise more money, obviously. And we're seeing that as the trend that's continued to be more prevalent over the past couple of years. And there's astronomical growth. In 2019, there was $5 billion of mining hardware that was deployed. So it's considerable and growing. How are you guys looking at the further financialization of mining? Have you looked at, you know, some of the other financial products that are currently springing up around mining itself? I know there's tons of different products like the sale and lease back option, for one example. Do you look at those bespoke deals?
Definitely. So there's a firm that we've known for a while. I don't know if they've ever been mentioned on here, but they're called Arctos Capital.
Yeah. Trevor was on the show.
Okay, great. So I might be spoiling a press release that's coming out. we've done some stuff with them in a sale lease back structure, which is what they're kind of leaning into, where, you know, we've been kind of like a part of the financing package to enable the financing package to be larger. So yes, we've also looked at, you know, different ways to hedge. I mean, if you use an analogy of like gold miners or, you know, other commodity producers like oil producers, typically they have quite a bit of, you know, debt financing built into their financial model. And in some cases, it might make sense for them to kind of collar the price of the commodity that they're producing using derivatives or other instruments. We've looked at that. I'd say that's kind of as far as we've gone to date. I don't think we've done our homework quite yet on like hash rate hedging and hash rate kind of derivatives, but I know that it's something that a couple of platforms have either already come out with in terms of a product that you can trade around. I think we'll get there probably pretty soon, but we haven't actually gotten a deal done in any way, shape, or form yet that uses one of those hash rate products.
I think those are a couple of years out from adoption. The bespoke deals are there and there are definitely opportunities to capture some business, but I think at scale, still a bit early. FTX launched synthetic derivatives on their platform and the volume's been okay. You know, until you can get an accurate price on hash rate, you're able to then, you know, price back and set a model that makes sense and then get the actual hash rate that can settle those contracts all in one package. It can be tricky. There's just a lot of moving parts. So I think that it'll take some time for that industry to continue to form. But yeah, it's awesome that you guys are looking at those. I think, I mean, that's, you know, we're called Hash Rate Podcast for a reason, right? We like to focus on that particular commoditization of compute for sure.
Yeah. I mean, maybe educate me a bit. I know I'm supposed to be the guest, but I'd love to learn for 2 or 3 minutes, like, you know, just how do you think about this stuff? Like, I mean, like if you had to make an assumption on what's going to happen to the hash rate over the next 6 to 24 months, are you just assuming it grows at like 10% a month or something? I mean, it's been relatively volatile. What's it most correlated to? Like, and how would you, if you were setting up a mining business, like have a mental model for thinking about it? Because that's the biggest difference, right? From a traditional commodity producer, if I'm going to have a gold mine or an oil field, can use whatever the latest and greatest tools are to predict how much of the stuff that I want to pull out of the ground is in the ground. I know how much the equipment costs to buy it. And then I just need to finance that, pull it out of the ground, and maybe, you know, hedge out my risk of the market price of the commodity whenever I'm ready to sell it. In cryptocurrency mining, you have to do all of that. And the hash rate, you know, might go up or down dramatically while you're in the middle of producing it, which could have an impact on your production capacity.
Definitely hash rate's going to continue to increase year over year, you know, especially as machines get more efficient and there's more availability of them. And that's going to be on the hardware side, a continuous cycle. They're always going to work to make the machines more efficient, and miners will always be lined up to buy the most efficient machines so that they can increase their own personal hash rate. Now, as a function, with hash rate increasing, you also have difficulty increasing. Now, when difficulty increases, that makes it harder to mine a block, so miners are less profitable. So hash rate increasing doesn't mean that miners are going to be more profitable. Oftentimes, it's the inverse. Now, that said, more conservative firms now are already using these hedging products to guard against the downside because they are less speculative and they want to make sure that they are locking in those profits in anticipation that, you know, maybe it's Bitcoin's price that drops, or maybe hash rate, you know, has a massive run up with the new deployment of machines like we saw in August and September. But either way, they want to make sure that they're locking in those profits. The reason that I don't think there's more adoption right now is just because, like, Bitcoin miners are the most bullish Bitcoiners. They are super long. They've spent millions of dollars of hardware to support Bitcoin's network and to accumulate these cheap Bitcoin. And they want to make sure that they're maximizing their upside. I think when we'll really see adoption of these hash rate derivatives and the other products, which they're most correlated to the price of Bitcoin. There are other factors that play into it, like the price of hardware or the cost of electricity, but the price of hardware is correlated to Bitcoin. You know, the price of electricity and where someone is mining and what they're paying for electricity is dictated by how cheaply they can produce Bitcoin, which obviously is also correlated to the price of Bitcoin, because if you're going to produce Bitcoin at $4,000 and the price is $5,000, that's not as attractive as if you can produce it for $1,800 and the price is $5,000. So the price of Bitcoin dictates all things within the entire ecosystem, but mining as well. Where I think we'll see the real uptick in adoption for these hedging products is when we have a new all-time high and then Bitcoin's price stabilizes. Because right now, a lot of the miners are, like I said, speculating and they're super long. And I think once we cross through that $20,000 threshold, then I think they will have realized the upside that they were waiting for. And then once they see the market stabilize, now it becomes a good opportunity to start hedging because the market is cyclical. And what we've seen in the past is usually after a new all-time high, there's a considerable drawdown in price. And you don't want to be in a position where you're super long Bitcoin and you're overexposed. And now the price draws down 80%, your mining profitability, as far as the operation itself, can still, you know, function because there will be miners that capitulate. But you have the ability through these hedging products to guard against that downside and not really risk your operations as they are. You know, right now, if you're buying a hash rate contract, it can be a great opportunity to speculate on the price of Bitcoin by locking in a lower purchase price on each coin itself. You know, if I'm buying a hash rate contract from a miner, it would be like buying, you know, spot Bitcoin at a discount. Now, the flip side of that is once we hit a new all-time high, is that value proposition still there? Only time will tell. That's why I don't think that these are quite ready just yet, but they're certainly coming to a point where we're very, very close. We're very close to being able to put this all together in a way that makes sense for the miners, that makes sense for the buyer. And right now we're just waiting for that next all-time high with Bitcoin and for price to stabilize. And then we'll see. So,
and obviously, I mean, look, if you, the more stability that comes to the Bitcoin price or the predictability of your output in the mining business, the easier it gets to finance more of your costs with debt versus equity. And so yes, you'll kind of see all of these things just continue to move in the right direction, basically. So it's kind of like the way certain hedging works in like electricity energy production markets. I guess you could think of it in a similar way. And hopefully you don't have some Enron type person who comes in and screws up games the whole thing.
True. But Zach, so you've built this amazing company, and I know you have a team that you've built it with. What was it that led you to this? Like, why BlockFi in 2017?
So I graduated from college in May of 2009. I always thought I would work in financial industry. I've always been attracted to numbers and risk management. I was a kind of an avid poker player, you could say semi-professional poker player throughout college. And it was a horrible time to be looking for a job in finance because we were, you know, just coming out of the financial crisis.
Yeah.
So I ended up getting a job because I had a friend who worked there at a digital advertising startup, which actually was, you know, kind of part of this trend at the time of the exchangeification of the digital advertising industry. So there was a little bit of a financial component to it, but nothing like what actually happens in finance. And that company ended up doing incredibly well. So, you know, I was employee number 17. It had a ton of fun, learned a lot, and like fast forward 3.5 years, I'd kind of moved up the ranks within the org. Company was a couple hundred people, and we got bought by Google. And I went to Google, and I kind of hated it because I felt like it was just this huge organization, and I couldn't do anything. I didn't matter. I was like young and, you know, wanted to like keep building stuff. And so going to Google was kind of the learning experience for me that I really enjoyed startups and smaller teams and creating something new and moving fast. So basically from that point on, I worked at startup companies, venture-backed companies. I did one more in the ad tech sector, but then more relevantly for BlockFi, I moved into fintech, specifically the online lending side of fintech, which went through a kind of similar excitement phase as I would say crypto did in 2017. But it was longer ago, and it was like peer-to-peer lending is going to take over the world. Banks are screwed. Technology is going to disrupt all this stuff. And I learned a lot from my time in that industry. There was one fundamental difference, which is that that entire industry and a lot of fintech companies these days hadn't actually built anything that was fundamentally new. They basically just took a mobile app and, you know, stamped it on top of the existing financial system.
Right.
And so I was working in that industry. I was writing a personal finance blog. I learned about Bitcoin. I was recommending that people buy it on this tiny little blog that I had. This is back in like late 2014, early 2015. And really at the time, my idea was two things. You know, one, this is actually something completely new. You know, we've never had a new currency slash commodity built on a new payment rail breakthrough in computer science. I was like, I don't know, it's completely new, could be huge. And the other thing was that it seemed like it had this just incredible asymmetric return profile. It was at, I think it was around 300 the first time I bought it. Maybe it goes to zero, you know, but it could go to 3,000. Who knows, right? Like, and my, you know, risk tolerance and the way I manage my investments is that I like things like that. I think especially as a young person, you want to have in your investment portfolio opportunities that have that kind of asymmetric upside. I ended up being right after I bought it the first time and Bitcoin went to 600 and I sold it all and was like, look at you, you're a genius. And most of my Bitcoin that I still have now was acquired at a higher price than 600, unfortunately, but that's when I started kind of paying attention. And then I learned about Ethereum in 2016. I got kind of excited about that. I invested in it pretty early. I made this analogy, which I don't necessarily think is great these days, but I was like, maybe Bitcoin was the BlackBerry and Ethereum's the iPhone. And then basically because the prices started going up in late 2016 and early 17, I was just getting more and more interested in it and reading about it and trying to talk about it at home. And eventually my wife was like, I don't want to talk about cryptocurrency. You need to start going to some like meetups or something. Like you can have Tuesday, every week you can have Tuesday and go, you know, hang out with some cryptocurrency people. And I started doing that. And I just reached a point where I was like, I have to get involved in this full time. I started believing in it more. I started meeting other people who were working in the space. I thought that not only did it present a really interesting industry to work in and an exciting professional opportunity, but I also thought that it was something that could truly change the world for the better over time, similar to the internet, but for money. I believe that. And I had the idea because I had been working in online lending that, you know, the space was going to need debt and credit markets. I was well positioned to build a company around that idea because I knew all these people in private credit and like I built something similar just in a different way. And I mentioned that to someone at a meetup. It was actually Chris Dannon was the first person I ever told about it. I don't know if he's been on, he's done stuff in cryptocurrency mining. It's like, hey, I have this idea. Like, what do you think? He was like, it's a fucking great idea. You need to start the business. And I was like, okay. And so I like went home and I was like, honey, I think I'm going to like start, you know, quit my job and start a cryptocurrency company. And at first she was like, what? And then, you know, after a weekend of like, you know, talking about it and thinking through, just decided to do it. And so that was it. I mean, the hardest part, honestly, of BlockFi was the first 6 months because we were trying to raise our seed round smack dab in the middle of the ICO boom. And we were too crypto for normal fintech investors. Yep. And we were not,
didn't have a token.
And we were not crypto enough for crypto investors. Yeah. So like the fintech people are like, this is too cutting edge. I don't know, like debt and shit for crypto. Like, I don't even know what Bitcoin is yet. Like, what are you talking about? And the crypto people are like, you're raising a normal equity round? You idiot. Like ICOs are the way of the future. Like you clearly don't get it. Like, But once we like got the like first, I mean, it was $1.5 million. That was our first round of financing. After we got that first money and we were able to launch the first product, we just kept working and listening to our clients and building onto those products. And the snowball kind of got in motion and started rolling downhill a little bit, I guess.
Momentum, man. Momentum. You guys definitely have picked it up. And it's been awesome to watch the company's growth. And I'm excited to see what you guys have coming next. The card itself sounds fantastic. I will be a user of that for sure.
Can I give you a sneak peek and you just verbally react? I know we're not recording.
Yeah, let's do it. Yeah,
we're going to release this publicly in like a month, you know, like what the card looks like, but I'll show you and you can just give it a 1 to 10 rating. So it's going to be, it's going to be this one in the upper left. I like that one.
I like the edge.
Right? Yeah. The BlockFi blue edge.
That is sexy.
Right?
Oh man. God, that's so nice. Yeah. And the logo placement, I mean, the way it'll sit in my money clip. Yeah, I like that. I like that.
Cool, right?
Yeah.
You insert the chip into a card and you've just got the Bitcoin B just like sticking out.
It's a statement. The thoughtfulness of design, I think, is something that, especially with cards, gets overlooked too often. You know, like when you get to like the higher tiers of cards, it's different. But like for the everyday card, that gets lost because, I mean, these companies don't spend enough time and they're not as thoughtful providing that nice looking card. But I think in this case, it's fucking sick, man. You guys did a good job.
Thanks. I'm so excited. I want it. Like, I get so mad. Everything we've built at BlockFi, I like wanted personally because I love this stuff. Like, I get so mad. I actually get frustrated like every time I spend money. I bought my coffee this morning and I'm my like, you know, stupid Amex. And I'm just like, God, like when, like, I'm like the CEO of this company. I should get the first one, but like, when is it going to happen? But it's coming soon. The team has done so much work. Like launching a credit card is not easy. Every product, every, you know, card products that's existed in the crypto space so far has been a debit card. The big difference from a consumer perspective between a debit and a credit card is basically that, you know, with a credit card, you can get a much higher rewards rate, which we wanted to do because we don't want to be like, hey, get, you know, 0.5% back on every purchase. It's like, if you're already getting 2%, that's like a tough pill to swallow.
Right.
And then in terms of actually operating the card, it's way harder because you're giving someone credit. I mean, just think about it functionally, right? Like debit card, you put $5 into the account, you can spend $5 on the card. With a credit card, it's like, no, people are just spending money that you had to. It's not like the money doesn't have to be there for them to spend it. It's just like, it didn't come from the person yet.
Right.
There's a lot more that goes into it and you have to work with a bank and a card network and all this stuff. And we've blazed a little bit of a trail in terms of some of these partners that I'm sure other folks will follow. Like, we'll probably be the first Bitcoin rewards credit card. We will definitely not be the last. And I'm actually excited about that too, because it's going to bring a ton of awareness to the space. And at the end of the day, as a consumer myself that loves Bitcoin, I'm like, yeah, let a bunch of people launch cards and like compete to, you know, give me like the best bang for my buck.
Right.
So hopefully launching this is going to be helpful in terms of attention on the sector in general, and also helpful in terms of the product environment for folks like ourselves who, you know, love Bitcoin, want to get more of it. And the more companies that are competing for our business, the better for us.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Consumers will win in that case for sure. Well, Zach, thanks for making the time, man. This was a great chat. Appreciate you coming on the show.
I enjoyed it. Thanks for having me, man.
Yeah. Before we sign off here, why don't you let everyone know where they can find you?
Sure. So I'm on Twitter, BlockFi Zach, Z-A-C. Our company's on Twitter too. We actually recently got the @BlockFi handle. We used to be @TheRealBlockFi and now we're @BlockFi.
So nice.
That happened like yesterday. And, you know, like I mentioned earlier, like we love to hear from folks, our support team, our client service team. You can reach at support@BlockFi.com. We've got a phone number, 646-779-9688. You can call that. Like, one of the people who's here in the office with me, I'll answer the phone and they'll be pumped to talk to you about whatever questions or thoughts you might have. So don't hesitate to reach out.
That's awesome. And to all the listeners of the show, we'll put all of the relevant notes in the show's links. You can access that information and get right over to BlockFi. It's been a great show. Zach, thanks for joining me. And to all the listeners out there, I appreciate you guys for tuning in. Talk to you guys all again very soon. Thanks for listening to Hashrate Podcast, a Hashrate Media production. If you enjoy great mining content, head over to hashrate.com today and register for Difficulty Adjustment, our free weekly newsletter providing the most actionable information on Bitcoin and mining. That's hashr8.com. Also, remember to head over today and give Hashrate a follow on Twitter. That's @Hashrate, @H4SHR8. Thank you again for tuning into the show. We'll talk to you all again very soon.